Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, the first thing I have to tell you today is that we do have a change in programming. We were going to be joined by Jane Velez-Mitchell. She's a television reporter, has her own show on HLN, and we were going to talk about the Jodi Arias case from a domestic abuse look perspective. Unfortunately, Jane, since she is a live TV journalist, got called in on a story today and can't join us. Now, the good news is that on Friday, I did an interview with somebody who's written an awesome book. He is Paul Barrett, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that in a moment. It's a true story, reads like a fiction book. You can't believe the twists and turns in it. And it has actually been optioned as a movie, and I think it would make a great movie. Coming up around 12, 2025, we will have an interview with Lucinda Franks. She's coming up to Seattle. She's a great writer, has worked for The New Yorker, The New York Times, has written a great book called Timeless, Love, Morgenthau, and Me. And her husband was Morgenthau, the district attorney of New York County for 35 years. And this book is a testament to their love story, but it's also about some of the work they did and how they got together. It's a really interesting story, almost 30 years age difference between them. And we'll end today's show with self-professed cowboy Alan Day, H. Alan Day. He's written a book called The Horse Lover, A Cowboy's Quest to Save the Wild Mustangs. And he's done some great work in that area. So I look forward to talking with him live around 12:40 today. But first, we're going to bring you an interview I did on Friday with Paul M. Barrett. He is the assistant managing editor and senior writer at Bloomberg Business Week. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller Glock, The Rise of America's Gun, American Islam, The Struggle for the Soul of a Religion, and The Good Black, A True Story of Race in America. And this book is called The Law of the Jungle, The 19 Billion. I can't speak today. We've been rushing around trying to get this ready for you. Law of the Jungle, The $19 Billion Legal Battle Over Oil in the Rainforest and the Lawyer Who'd Stop at Nothing to Win. And this is really an incredible story. It's a story not so much of the pollution that was caused by Texaco, which of course became Chevron. It is about the legal battle, but it's mostly about the attorney involved at the center of the story. So I'm going to bring that interview to you right now with Paul M. Barrett. Okay, so Paul, let's begin with the book itself. You discuss the pollution caused by Texaco, which is now, of course, Chevron, and the subsequent legal battle between Chevron and Ecuador, but it's mostly about the American lawyer.
Well, yes. The story that I wanted to tell, the primary story, was how an idealistic American lawyer who set out to use the rule of law to hold a powerful multinational corporation accountable for its conduct, in this case, in the rainforest in Ecuador, ended up undermining the rule of law. And I wanted to get at the very important lessons that long episode teaches. And certainly the underlying story of the pollution and the human suffering that lies behind it is crucial, and I spend a fair amount of time on that as well. But I thought the portrait of this man and his evolution over time was a compelling way of getting at these issues.
Right, and he did win a $19 billion judgment against Chevron.
That's right.
Instead of paying up, Chevron encountered a legal attack against him. Tell us a little bit about that, because it's so involved. This has been going on for years and years, hasn't it?
Absolutely. This is a legal fight that actually began in 1993. The underlying issues go back all the way to the 1960s when oil exploration in the rainforest region of Ecuador first began. By the early 1990s, Texaco, the American company that had been involved with that oil production, had been kicked out of Ecuador. The oil industry there had been nationalized. And Texaco returned to the United States to a plaintiff's lawyer welcome, a lawsuit filed by Stephen Donziger, a New York plaintiff's attorney, among some other lawyers. And they wanted to hold Texaco responsible for the side effects of the industrialization of the rainforest. And this legal battle raged furiously for years, 9 years in the United States before the United States courts ultimately dismissed it, but then it restarted again like a forest fire almost in Ecuador. And in 2011, Donziger, by now the sole lead lawyer of the plaintiff's legal team, won this extraordinary $19 billion verdict. This was a record-setting judgment, the largest single environmental judgment in a trial ever anywhere. And the really remarkable thing about it was that Stephen Donziger had filed only this one lawsuit in his entire career since he had graduated from Harvard Law School in 1991. His one and only lawsuit, and it resulted in this record verdict against one of the most powerful companies in the world. But as you correctly said, Chevron said, we are not going to pay a dime on this. The pollution is not our responsibility. It's actually Ecuador's responsibility for legal reasons, and we can talk about that if you wish. But meanwhile, we are not only going to refuse to pay, but we are going to lash back at this plaintiff's lawyer. The company had been investigating him for several years, and the company filed suit against him back in the United States under the U.S. anti-racketeering law. And that lawsuit led to a judgment against Donziger. So the tables were turned. The prey, the corporate defendant, became the aggressor. And Donziger was found liable back in the United States under the racketeering law by a federal judge in New York who said his lawsuit, his campaign on behalf of the poor people in Ecuador, had turned into a corporate shakedown, one that was fueled by bribery, forged documents, false scientific evidence, and coercion of judges. So a story of the sort that, after covering legal matters for 30 years, I've just never seen anything like it.
Yeah, well, they say truth is stranger than fiction, and this would actually
That's right.
A great fiction, a fiction story, but unfortunately it's not. There are no real heroes in this story because, you know, I want to look a little at Stephen Donziger because, you know, I start reading the book and I think he sounds a great guy. He's 50, he's 6'4", he dresses like a grad student, you say, he rides a bicycle, not a typical corporate lawyer, but he changed along the way, right? And you say everything about him fascinates you, and I can understand why. Tell us a little bit about him.
Sure. Before becoming a lawyer, he actually was a journalist for 4 years. He covered the Nicaraguan Civil War in the early 1980s between the Sandinistas and the American-backed right-wing Contras. He was very much impressed by the Sandinistas and swept up in what he saw as the romance of their leftist revolution, not a view that everyone would agree with, but there you have it. He decided that being a journalist really didn't fully satisfy him. He wanted to be more of a protagonist, not an observer, not someone on the sidelines. Came back to the United States, became a prisoner advocate on behalf of Cuban immigrant prisoners who had come to this country in the Mariel boat lift and then had ended up by the hundreds and hundreds in U.S. prisons. And then he went to law school, to Harvard Law School, and he decided that there he's going to become an activist and became a leader of campus protests and a very outspoken figure. A couple of years out of Harvard Law School, one of his law school classmates introduced him to the classmate's father, who had just filed this lawsuit in Ecuador. And this became Stephen Donziger's cause. This became the animating undertaking in his life. The case became him. He became the case. He was a fluent Spanish speaker. He knew his way around Latin America, and he threw himself into this wholeheartedly. And, I, you know, I personally, I tend tend to operate by giving people the benefit of the doubt, at least initially. And I would assume that his motives at first included altruistic motives, mm-hmm. although no doubt they were seeking money. So, but that's all right. Lawyers are allowed to seek money under our system. But over time, as you say, I think hubris, the media attention the case gathered, the celebrity backing it gathered, and the notion that billions and billions of dollars might be able to be squeezed out of Chevron changed his mindset, and I think he basically lost his bearings.
Yeah, and can we just talk a little bit about what Ecuador looked like before all of this happened and then after it happened?
Sure.
Because there again, sure. you see a huge change.
Absolutely.
We're talking about the rainforest pre-70s. I think it was 64 when the first helicopter came in, right?
Yeah. Well, before all this happened, in one sense, the rainforest was a largely pristine rainforest. But it actually is important right from the outset to emphasize that our romantic notions of how these stories unfold really stumble and crash against the facts. For example, the narrative that's been told in connection with this lawsuit and this campaign is that before the oil companies showed up in the mid-1960s to begin exploration, there's a scene in the book I portray of the helicopters showing up over the rainforest canopy and the indigenous tribe members looking up and not, you know, fully understanding exactly what these huge silver birds are that are whopping in and men are dropping down, rappelling down on ropes and so forth.
Right.
Well, that's true as far as it goes, and I take the word of those tribe members who told me that story, that was their experience. But in fact, that was not their first exposure to outsiders. There had been rubber traders in this region in the 1910s and 1920s who had subjected the predecessors, the antecedents of these very same Indians to something very close to slave labor, and the rubber traders basically faded away during the global depression of the 1930s, and the indigenous populations to some degree recovered, but then they had rather bruising interaction with evangelists, with missionaries who came both from Spain and from the United States. So this was actually a region that, while on the one hand it was pristine in some ways, it was not untouched, and it was not the Garden of Eden. But in any event, the oil company shows up in the 1960s. Oil begins to flow in the 1970s. And while the oil industry became the backbone of the Ecuadorian economy overall, 50% of Ecuador's GDP, generating billions of dollars in proceeds, Ecuador's poorest people did not benefit tremendously from this. The poorest people in relative terms actually got poorer, even as a middle class developed in faraway Quito, the capital, where there were petroleum engineers and lawyers and white-collar workers and so forth who benefited. And beyond the economic issue, there was the environmental issue, because while oil was being produced in very large volumes, there was tremendous ecological damage. Texaco dug unlined waste oil pits by the hundreds, filled them, and then just abandoned them. The company dumped billions of gallons of tainted production water. This is the water that comes up with oil when you produce oil from underground, and you need to separate the water from the hydrocarbon, and then you put the oil into the pipeline, and the water needs to be disposed of. Well, there are safe ways of disposing of the water, but those are not the methods that Texaco used. Texaco simply discharged it on the surface, which means they discharged it into the streams and rivers where people drew their drinking water, where people bathed their children. And this was simply, by our contemporary standards, misconduct. Now, it was the fact that the Ecuadorian government was aware of what Texaco was doing, and the Ecuadorian government looked the other way. Nevertheless, by my standards anyway, this was corporate conduct that deserves condemnation.
Right.
Texaco operated in this fashion for two decades before the oil industry was nationalized and Texaco was forced to leave the country.
Right. And so where does the Ecuadorian responsibility fall in this? Because they're not totally
yes.
blameless. They had some form of partnership, right?
Absolutely. This is another, you know, while there's the sort of Garden of Eden myth that
yeah.
it was the oil company were the first outsiders, there's also the myth, and it's really, in a lot of ways, a very patronizing as well as misleading myth that a country such as Ecuador is somehow passive and prostrate and being 100% taken advantage of. There's the suggestion that the oil company sneaks in the dark of night, does its evil work, takes all the money out, and leaves behind only the devastation. Simply not so. Texaco showed up at Ecuador's invitation. Texaco did its work under contract, a series of contracts, with the government of Ecuador. And for the majority of the time that this consortium, this oil operation, was taking place in a swath of land in the rainforest about the size of Rhode Island, the Ecuadorian government owned the majority of the consortium. The majority of the oil was sold by the government of Ecuador, and they kept the proceeds. I found government records in Ecuador that showed that of the $25 billion generated during the 1970s and 1980s, 90% of that money stayed in Ecuador because Ecuador owned most of the oil, and Ecuador very aggressively taxed the oil that Texaco was allowed to sell. Now, I'm not saying that exonerates Texaco in any way, but what it does do is it implicates Ecuador in what was going on.
Right, right.
Moreover, there was a provision in the contract under which Texaco was operating that said that all the participants in the oil consortium would have to follow Ecuador's environmental rules, and they would be subject to the supervision of the appropriate Ecuadorian agencies. I actually interviewed the Ecuadorian lawyer, now in his late 80s, who negotiated that contract in the early 1970s on behalf of the Ecuadorian military junta that ran the country at that time. And I asked him, sir, I was in his law office, he's still working. I said, show me the provision in the contract, which he's very proud of, by the way, this contract, because it advanced his country economically. I said, show me the environmental provisions. He said, absolutely. And he thumbed through the contract, and he found a four-line paragraph. He said, there it is. I said, please read it to me. He read it to me, and I just summarized it. And I said, very interesting. What were the relevant environmental agencies? And he said, oh, there were none. So, in other words, the government negotiated this contract, said to Texaco, you must follow our rules and follow our agencies, and there were no agencies. I mean, and this was Ecuador's lawyer telling me this. So, again, this doesn't exonerate anybody. It merely implicates more parties and shows that this was an activity where everybody was looking away from the side effects. Everybody wanted the money. Texaco wanted money, the Ecuadorians wanted money, and no one wanted to deal with the collateral damage.
Right. So I'm wondering, this bounce back and forwards between the cases between New York and between Ecuador, I'm wondering how long this took you to research this book, because everybody's pointing fingers at everybody else, and there are so many twists and turns in it. It is like a fiction story.
It is indeed, and the book you have reflects, at this point, going on 4 years of intensive research. It began with a cover story that I wrote for Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, where I am on staff, and I wrote that cover story immediately after that initial huge victory by Donziger, or the seeming victory, the $19 billion judgment in February 2011. When that came down, I had been watching this case for a period of years. I had always been curious about it, fascinated by it, and then suddenly it became much more real. He won, I said to myself.
Right.
We've got to explain to our readers, to Bloomberg Businessweek's readers, who is this guy? Like, who won this extraordinary verdict against this massive company? And so I went out and I did what I do. I sprinted around and in the space of 3-4 weeks did a sort of a rough first draft, which we ran in the magazine. That article, interestingly, was headlined Amazon Crusader, Corporate Gadfly, Fraud? Because questions were already being raised as to what methods he'd used to win this victory. But at that point, there were question marks because, you know, when you work on something for 3 or 4 weeks, although I was aware of the case before that, I had never really looked at it firsthand myself, looking at the documents and so forth. But I was so fascinated by it that once we ran this somewhat tentative initial personality profile of him. I then went down to Ecuador for the first time, saw this extraordinary scene of the oil industry in the middle of the rainforest with all these poor people living only yards away from the oil operations, the pipelines snaking everywhere over every stream and next to every road. There's pipelines that are steaming in the mist as it's, you know, constantly raining, and the hot petroleum is running through the pipelines. It's an extreme, you know, there are natural gas flares burning everywhere over the trees as the natural gas that also comes up with the oil is being burned off. It's an extraordinary setting. And I said, well, this is a book. This is much more than a magazine article. And that's when I launched into the book research.
Right. And the book, of course, is Law of the Jungle. And so what do you say to people who say, well, you know, we all know that big corporate lawyers play dirty games. Don Zucco was just trying to level the playing field. And you actually say in the book, the company Chevron, as Don Zucco saw it, fought dirty. He fought back in kind. But he manipulated evidence. He did a lot of extreme politicking. What do you say to people who say he's just trying to level the playing field?
Yeah. Well, do you remember when your mother told you two wrongs don't make a right?
Exactly.
Yeah. You remember when your mother told you that you can't take any means even to a just end? When you are fighting for justice, when you are purporting to represent the little guy, when you are seeking a court judgment that you want to make meaningful, it has to be done within the rules. You cannot use the rule of law to discipline a corporate antagonist, even if the corporate antagonist has done something wrong, by getting down into the muck and violating the laws. And the fact is that it has been proven that Don Zucco, whatever Chevron did in the litigation of this case, Don Zucco far outdid them. Mm. We're talking here about the bribing of judges, the forging of documents, the submission of ghost-written documents that are supposed to be written by neutral court-appointed lawyers, but it turns out are actually ghost-written by Don Zucco's paid advisors. You know, it's one thing to be Robin Hood in the forest shooting arrows at the Sheriff of Nottingham, you know, bending the rules a little bit, but for the greater good. You know, an outlaw good guy can do that. A revolutionary can do that. Even a politician maybe can do that. A lawmaker can cut compromises to get past an imperfect piece of legislation that may on balance improve the world, and maybe he's got to twist some arms to get it done. But fighting in court is a different kind of battle. Yeah. And the rules are more specific, and they're narrower and more constrained. And if you're going to choose that venue, you have to follow the rules of that venue.
And so, Paul, what do you think the legacy of this case will be? Do you think there will be a hero in the end? And how is this going to affect future cases when people want to go up against corporate lawyers?
The precedents so far are all negative. Sadly, the legacy of the case is the undercutting of the credibility of this kind of international human rights litigation, the emboldening of corporate targets of such litigation who have now been given a new and to many corporate lawyers, thrilling playbook for how to fight back against claims that corporations have misbehaved. It has contributed to a growing cynicism within the judiciary in the United States over the nature of these kinds of mass lawsuits. Those kinds of lawsuits are being cut back across the board in the United States, from the United States Supreme Court on down, and this case will only become another exhibit, another argument in the brief that we ought to steer away from. We ought to pull back on these kinds of mass lawsuits that purport to represent thousands and thousands of people, as opposed to the traditional lawsuit where it's one person or maybe a small group of people against one defendant or maybe a small group of defendants. So that's the sad legacy of the case so far. Will there be a hero? Well, there aren't any heroes that I can see on the horizon right now. There certainly are victims. I mean, there are people here who are simply bystanders, who are collateral damage. And I think the potential for a hero might be some public figure or some public institution that could somehow show up on the scene here and supplant this endless Dickensian litigation. A very interesting proposal has been made by a lawyer named Bert Newborn, who who's a professor, a human rights professor at NYU. Bert Newborn is actually now representing Donziger's clients in the appeal of the racketeering case. Donziger has one lawyer, and his clients have been given a separate lawyer, this man Newborn. And Newborn has written about the advisability of trying to supplant endless litigation with foundations and administrative structures that can end the fighting and actually collect some money together and get some reparations done. And he has suggested in his writings that the resolution of Holocaust-related liability lawsuits against German companies that employed slave labor during World War II might provide a model for resolving this situation in Ecuador, which is very far-fetched sounding, but he's a brilliant man, and perhaps some character like that who comes in with a really kind of outside-the-box proposal might be the person who could bring an end to the seemingly endless legal warfare and propose some type of compromise that would get some relief to the people who need relief and send the lawyers home after these 21 years of litigating.
Right. Well, it is a fascinating story. This book is so well written, The Law of the Jungle, the $19 billion legal battle over oil in the rainforest and the lawyer who stopped, who'd stop at nothing to win. What do you have a final thought to leave with our listeners?
Well, I appreciate your interview. I would note that the judge who sat on the case, the racketeering portion of the case, who ruled in Chevron's favor and said that Donziger had evolved into a racketeer, he said in his ruling March of this year, he said, "This case has facts that normally only come out of Hollywood." And I think that's a good observation. I would agree with him. I hope and think that this will become a movie at some point. In fact, I've sold an option on the book to a Hollywood production company, and I think, sadly, it will be a very dark movie.
Mm. Well, Paul Barrett, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And that was an interview I did on Friday with Paul M. Barrett, who is the assistant managing editor and senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. And it really is a fascinating story, true story. Again, Law of the Jungle is the name of the book, and it's just full of twists and turns. And this is happening in our court system and has been happening for 20 years, as we said. Well, please do stay with us. You can find out more about Paul Barrett at authorpmbarrett.com, authorpmbarrett.com. And of course, you can find out more about him at businessweek.com. as well. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Hi, I'm Charlie. I fight fires and I save lives.
My name's Renee. I'm a cardiologist. I save lives.
My name's Anthony. I'm an EMT. I save lives.
You don't have to be a professional to save a life. Firefighters, doctors, and others save lives. You can too. Don't wait. To learn more about the warning signs and how you can help prevent suicide, visit save.org. In a crisis, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Good news, Belgium. We're streamed worldwide at 1150kknw.com. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And coming up next, I have a recording that I did last week with Lucinda Franks. She is coming to Seattle. She's the author of the acclaimed memoir, My Father's Secret War. She's a former staff writer for The New York Times, and she's also written for The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, and The Atlantic. She won a Pulitzer Prize at the age of 24, youngest woman ever to win at that time. And she is a graduate of Vassar College. She lives in New York City with her husband, the former longtime district attorney for New York County, Robert M. Morgenthau. And I have to apologize in advance because we couldn't get Lucinda live on the show. She's actually traveling today. We tried a bunch of permutations on this, but so I recorded her last week, and unfortunately the phone that she was calling in on was really bad quality. And Eric has done his very best to get this up, but you do have to listen to her carefully. And I kind of went backwards and forwards on should we air this, should we not air this. But since she's coming to Seattle, and I think she has a great story to tell, it's a great love story of her husband. She was just 26 when she met him. He was 53. And they've had a May December romance when May December romances didn't happen. They've been together 36 years. He's now 95, which puts Lucinda in her 60s. And she wanted to record some of their history together. He was the district attorney for such a long time and always refused to have anybody write about him but his wife, Lucinda. And I'm going to bring that to you again now. And again, I do apologize for the sound quality on this. You'll have to listen carefully to catch Lucinda. Let's begin with why you wrote this memoir about your 36-year marriage to a man that you call one of the great men of our time. Your husband had refused many biographers over the years, but obviously found it hard to say no to you. And you write, words by the millions have been printed about you, but none have revealed your real life, your secret life, which is that you belong to me. Tell us why you wanted to write this.
Well, Vicki, my husband is one of the greatest, unarguably, one of the greatest men of his era. He's the only one left from the Kennedy era where politicians were really statesmen. And he is a statesman with incredible integrity and sharpness, but he had an exterior of the typical prosecutor, stern, tough, reserved, and actually in everything he did, in party, political organizations, he was just, you know, one-dimensional. And I have to feel a subject to write about it, and I really felt my husband. I really felt his character. And I had enough irony and distance for, you know, after our 36 years of marriage to do it. And I expected him to say no. And we were at a romantic restaurant. And I said, sweetheart, what would you think of the idea of me writing a memoir about us you know, about you? And he looked up and said, well, do you think anybody'd read it? I said, I think so, sweetheart. I think they would. So he said, all right, fine. And I made a rule that he would read every draft, that every word in every draft that I wrote, because I wanted him to be happy with the result, and I wanted everything to be accurate.
Right. It sounds as though reading the book, Lucinda, as though it took you a little while to get to know him, because you write in the prelude, I can't get enough of you. I switch from channel to channel, trying to catch you, trying to understand your baffling persona. The husband I know has the sweet cadence of an oboe, and the husband I don't speaks with an Old Testament fury. So how long did it take you to get to know him, as you know him now?
About 30 years.
Yeah, I thought as I said that, I thought that's a stupid question.
just about that long. I never was able to figure him out. And on the surface, he was kind, tender, solicitous. But you brought up an emotional subject, and he could not even go there. He hid his emotions. Even from himself, I think. So, what was underneath this wonderful man took me a very long time. And I can illustrate this by telling you what happened when he was reading the drafts of my memoir. I would have to watch him read, say, a segment, and if there was a little twitch of a muscle in his cheek, I knew something was up, that he didn't like something about the segment, and I would ask him, and he would say, oh, well, you know, it's in your memory. And I said, no, it's our memory, and I want you to tell me. I would have to literally tease his objections to a passage out of him. Particularly if it wasn't a factual mistake.
Right.
If it was something that was, about feelings or, about some things we did together, that kind of thing.
Right. Now, the book isn't just about him, about the marriage. It's also about the work that you both did, because he was district attorney of New York County for 35 years. An outstanding record there. And you won the Pulitzer Prize at the age of 24, the youngest woman to receive the award at that time. And yet, you say as you got into the marriage, you became a society wife, you struggled to move forward your writing, and your husband Robert struggled to release memories of his first wife who died, his first wife who died from cancer. How did you get through that period?
It was a rough period. I think there's a myth about marriages. The first couple of years when you're drawing power lines and getting used to each other is very difficult. This was really difficult because, as I go into in the book, there was his five children. And so two of them were my age and felt like they'd been displaced. And the littlest one was 13. So I had to be, a kind of aunt, really, to her. And it was very difficult he wore his wedding ring from his first marriage up until about 2 months before we got married.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally said to him, Bob, if that ring doesn't come off, I'm not going to marry you. And the next day, it was off.
Mm.
That's how I go into, the way his modus operandi in life is to, he has to be really pushed to the wall before he makes a decision, which is counter to his prosecutorial image and practice, which is to make swift and prompt decisions about punishment, indictment, and that kind of thing.
You learned a lot, you say, about both of you in writing this book, which you heavily relied on journals that you'd kept since college to reconstruct your 36 years together.
What did you learn about Robert that you didn't already know when you were writing this?
You know, I learned how to read him and read his emotions. The book is filled, you know, with what happened in our life, which was sometimes hilarious misunderstandings because we just misunderstood each other. I couldn't read him. And I'm a very out front person. What you see is what you get. But with him, it's totally the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we had some really bad times where I read him the wrong way. So it really did take me 30 years. And as I was writing the book, I was making a story of our lives. And in examining that story, it's kind of a process of reinvention because you see what's behind and below all of the external things that you do. And I was able to see how I had misread him and how I should read him, how I should know when he is saying, I love you. It's not through saying, I love you, but through getting me a bowl of blueberries in the morning,
mm-hmm.
or taking me on a trip, or buying me a present. Doing for him, I discovered, is the same as loving
right.
for me.
And Lucinda, what did you learn about yourself? Because I don't think you can go through that process without some growth in yourself.
Yes, I did learn that I had been very impatient, that I had demanded of him things that he couldn't give. I had gone to a place where he couldn't go and was disappointed when he couldn't discuss psychological and emotional things with me. And, you know, I solved this by the way that so many women solve it, is that I got a lot of women friends that I was able to talk to in that way,
mm-hmm.
in the way that really women can only talk to women.
Right.
But my expectations were too high, and I realized that as my life became a story that was written down.
Well, I think it's a story that needed to be told, and I really enjoyed reading it, and I thank you for being with us today. What's a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with? I know you're coming out to Seattle, and I'll tell them all about that. What would you like to leave our listeners with?
I would like to leave the listeners with the conviction that I have that no matter whether you have a bad day, a bad month, a bad year, if you stick to your relationships, whatever they may be, really stick to them. If you love somebody, then you will do right by them, and you will do right by yourself.
And that was an interview I did last week with Lucinda Franks. And I do apologize for the quality of the line that Lucinda was calling in on. We did the best we could with that. But she is coming out to Seattle. A fascinating story because she describes herself as a, you know, young, pot-smoking, demonstrating hippie journalist. And she met this 53-year-old district attorney, and they were together. They are still together 36 years. He's now 95. So you can hear more from Lucinda. She's going to be at the Seattle Town Hall on October 2nd, 7:30 to 8:30. She'll be doing a talk and a signing. Again, that's Seattle Town Hall, October 2nd, 7:30 to 8:30. And if you've got any questions, you can always ping me at info@conversationslive.net. We will be back with Alan Day, so please do stay tuned. We'll be right back. Oh, and I should say, Lucinda Franks, just as a reminder here, her book is called Timeless, Love, Morgenthau, and Me. And Dan Rather, former newscaster and author of Rather Outspoken, says it's a rare book. It's rare for a book this candid and revealing to be so well written. It's a marvelous memoir with honesty, exuberance. It's unforgettable. And she has a reporter's eye for detail and the narrative talents of a novelist. And I'd agree with that. All right, please stay with us. We'll be right back.
you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Jones & Company Pets in Marysville, we cover the world of animals. This week, October 5th, our favorites, adventure travelers Helen and Bill Thayer. They've traveled the world on unbelievable journeys. Helen's written three great books and soon will release number four. She's created the Adventure Classroom, motivating and educating our kids, and this time they've asked to bring along a special guest. Join us to find out who, Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, New York Times and USA Today bestselling author Lori Foster joins us to discuss her ultimate series new release, No Limits. Later, London Times managing editor James McManus returns with his latest historical novel, Sleep in Peace Tonight. Join us Mondays at noon and listen to past shows at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Made fresh each day for you. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. Well, I'm very pleased to have H. Allen Day with me right now. He's written a great book. It's called The Horse Lover, A Cowboy's Quest to Save the Wild Mustangs. And he did write it with Lynn Wise Snide. I always like to give out co-authors a shout out here too. And the foreword in this book is by Sandra Day O'Connor, and I'll let him tell you the relationship there. But he is, he said that his upbringing branded him a cowboy from the day he was born. He was part of the third generation to grow up on the 200,000-acre Lazy Bee cattle ranch straddling the high deserts of southern Arizona and New Mexico. And for the next 40 years, he managed that ranch. During his career, he received numerous awards for his dedicated stewardship of the land. And in the 80s, Allen purchased a cattle ranch in Nebraska and soon after that, a ranch in South Dakota. The latter became the first government-sponsored sanctuary for unadoptable wild horses. And he's developed and successfully implemented a herd modification training program. We're going to hear a little bit about that right now. Allen Day, welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be on the air with you.
Very pleased to have you. And I said that the foreword had been written by Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman, as we know, on the Supreme Court Justice. And she grew up on that ranch with you. She's your sister, right?
She and I grew up on the Lazy Bee, and, you know, it affected strongly the rest of our lives, of course. You grow up in that environment, and you see the world a little differently, I think. We always were, it was hammered into us there that if something went wrong, it was up to us to fix it. We couldn't pick up the phone and call Roto-Rooter or, you know, anything else. I mean, if something bad happened, gee whiz, right, figure it out and fix it.
Well, I have to say you look happy on it. I love the photograph we put of you on Facebook. You look happy on it. So I think it must have worked out well for you.
Yes. Life has been nice to me.
So you already owned and managed two ranches and needed a third, as you say, about as much as you needed a permanent migraine. But a realtor kept pestering you to take a look at an old ranch in South Dakota, and you finally relented and became owner of that described 35,000 acre sea of grass. So tell us about that and what happened when you bought that ranch.
Well, I two ranches was more than a full-time job to manage, but Joe Nutter just kept bugging me to go look at this ranch, and he said, oh, this is a wonderful ranch and you need to go. Finally gave in to look at the ranch just to get him off my back, and but had the strangest thing happen on the ranch road on the way in. I just had been there another time in my life, and I, or in another life maybe, I knew what I was going to see before I saw it, and I've never had an experience like that before, but I just felt like I was coming home from a long journey, and it felt so good to get home.
Right.
And so by the time we arrived at the headquarters, I was just totally in love with the ranch because I felt like a big weight had been lifted off my shoulders.
Oh, that's wonderful. So what point, because you were a cattle rancher, what point did you decide to get into taking Mustangs?
Well, the ranch, when I bought it, didn't have any cattle on it. The previous owner had gotten in financial trouble and sold all the cattle, and so it was kind of a blank slate. And the other two ranches I had about 4,000 mother cows with calves, and I thought, gee whiz, I have a lot of eggs in that basket, so I better do something different. I would like to do something different with this ranch to create some income to, you know, make it a flourishing ranch, but maybe not dependent on cows and calves. So this opportunity popped up just out of the blue that the government had a lot of wild horses that were unadoptable and that they had gathered off their native range, and they didn't know what to do with them. They had them in feedlots. And I went and looked at those, and I named it Horse Prison. These horses were all just crowded in feedlots, and they
right.
couldn't roam and be free like they had been. And the family units had been broken up, and they were there just in horse prison. So I determined, and there was no such thing as a wild horse sanctuary at the time, but I went and did the government that sea of grass that was the beautiful ranch there that I love so much was an ideal place to run 1,500 wild Mustangs, and ended up had to go to Washington to convince Congress that was a good idea, but was able to do that, and lo and behold, the horses started to arrive.
Right, and
it was a really incredible piece of my life.
It sounds like it, and it sounds like, you know, a dream come true for many people, I would think. What makes a horse unadoptable? Because you take the ones that are unadoptable, right?
Yes. Well, the government gathers more horses. The horses overpopulate when they're left alone. And so the government periodically has to take some off to make sure that the rest don't starve to death by overgrazing. So when they take some off, the young, pretty ones are the ones that people want to adopt. You know, here's a real pretty young year-old, two-year-old horse. But some of them are crippled. Some of them are one-eyed. Some of them are 20 years old, 15 years old. You know, just different reasons why they're not adoptable.
Mm. And it's not an easy process, as I understand, to get the government to approve a sanctuary. And, you know, over the years, you've gone backwards and forwards with them. You talk about a time when you were trying to buy horses and you were outbid by 1 cent and had to decide, do I go and sue the government? And you say that's the only time you've ever asked your sister, Sandra Day O'Connor, a legal question.
Yes. It was, and Sandra said, well, there is recourse. It was clearly a wrong action for them to take a bid. In order to save a penny, they had to get me to round up the horses, blood test them, get the permits, ship them to Oklahoma. It cost $80 so that they could save a penny.
Right. Amazing.
That doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, but that's bureaucracy for you. And I know you've had a belly full of bureaucracy. But what a great legacy that you're leaving with this and you know, doing everyday living. I mean, I would imagine it's a dream come true, is it?
Oh, it really was. Every day was just happy. And when I would get out with the horses and they would come up and look at me and give me a smile and say, oh, it's you. How are you doing today? And you know, that's just wonderful to be in that situation, and we would move them from pasture to pasture, and I had trained them to follow me. I'd go through and give them the signal and say, come on, boys, and here I'd hit a nice, easy little gallop, and here would be 1,500 horses about 10 feet behind me.
Right.
And
well,
what
Alan,
a thrill that is.
It's a wonderful story, and it's a wonderful book. It's called The Horse Lover, A Cowboy's Quest to Save the Wild Mustangs. And Booklist called it an instant classic. I want to let listeners know, Alan, that you are coming up to this area, and I have to do that really quickly. Thursday, October 2nd, 6 to 7 p.m., Alan Day will be doing a book signing at University Bookstore Bellevue. Again, that's University Bookstore Bellevue, Thursday, October 2nd. He will be at King's Books in Tacoma. That's the one on St. Helens Avenue, Saturday, October 4th, 2 till 4. And he will be at the Celebration of Western and Wildlife Art Show and Auction. I did not know there was such a thing. The Celebration of Western and Wildlife Art Show and Auction at Expo Hall at the Washington State Fair on October 3rd through 5th. So you can find out more about Alan there. And could you very quickly just give me the website? We have to get off air right now.
Well, the website is just The Horse Lover.
Thank you so much.
And
you can find out more about Alan at thehorselover.com. Thanks for being with us. We have to run. We have no time left. See you next week. Bye-bye.